Okay. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks. I'd like to correct a couple points, if I may.
Please.
First of all, the book is available in some bookstores. It's available from Amazon. It's available. It has been shipped and has been sold out in all the bookstores in Washington, D.C., although shipping is kind of sporadic with our publisher at this point. At the moment, the only guaranteed way to get the book is to come to our website, because we bought 20,000 copies of the book so that the profits on the book would go to From the Wilderness instead of Time Warner or somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
I would strongly recommend to your listeners, though, and I totally support the pledge drive, that everybody out there, everybody who's listening to KBOO, do the pledge drive purchases first until you guys run out of books, and then come to my website and buy them, because we are shipping right now, and we've been as high as 77 on the Amazon bestseller list, and none of our advertising or promo or none of the major reviews have come in yet, and we're doing very well. We have consistent 5-star ratings on the Amazon site. But some stores around the country sporadically do have the book. Amazon has been shipping, but Barnes & Noble says they won't have it until after the election. So go to KBOO first to support a wonderful radio station, then come to us to support us. I want to go back to that FEMA whole issue to clarify that very quickly, and then we can move on. Is that Tom Kennedy was Hyannis Fire Department. He was also FEMA, meaning that FEMA around the country maintains emergency response teams that are comprised of emergency responders in localities. In other words, here in Southern California, a FEMA response team may be LAPD, LA County Fire, and other people who, in an emergency, are called up to work for FEMA.
Okay, so they're kind of temporarily deputized kind of a thing?
Yeah. But there is no question that the Hyannis Fire Department contingent left on the night of September the 11th. That's a bit of disinformation that was spun to discredit people who would rely on it. There's plenty of other proof about FEMA and Tripod 2, which is outlined clearly in the book.
Right.
And that's why the standard of research has to be so high, so you don't fall into these traps.
Okay, well, thank you for the clarification. So now, we've spent the first segment talking about war games, making connections to the White House. One of the reasons that there needed to be, or when you have multiple war games going on, especially between agencies, and what I'm referring to is the fact that NORAD had war games going on, but the Pentagon's Joint Chiefs Staff also had war games going on. So there were multiple agencies. The National Reconnaissance Office also had something going on, but it was kind of peripheral, it seemed, to the larger events of the day.
Right.
When you have multiple war games, there's got to be someone who makes sure that, as you put, there's no cross-contamination.
Correct.
Now, there's discrepancies, wide discrepancies, regarding where Dick Cheney was and when, as well as what Donald Rumsfeld and Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, acting chairman at the time, were all doing. Can you kind of try and explain first what you think they were doing and why there needed to be confusion about where these folks were for a couple of hours that day?
One of the things that's so interesting about this is that if you look at the history of the Kane Commission and its investigations, what you find is that they kept changing times throughout the course of their reporting. And before they issued their final report last June, they arbitrarily changed timelines, contradicting sworn testimony, documents submitted under penalty of perjury. They just broke out an eraser and rewrote the timeline themselves without input from anybody to try and construct some kind of plausible explanation. And, of course, what they constructed is just junk. Clearly, we know from the FAA that phone bridges were established as early as 8:45. And using various documents and statements and stories to deconstruct statements, it looks very much to me, and I say it in the book, that Dick Cheney, you know, there was that whole thing where the Secret Service supposedly jumped up and rushed and carried him down to the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that happened right after Flight 175 became the second plane to impact the towers, and that Cheney probably was not carried. He probably sprinted past all the Secret Service to get there so that he could take control, because if you compare that with President Bush's activities, you see that he was on camera reading to the children, And Dick Cheney needed to be in operational control before the American press confronted the president and made him take control. And that's why he was delayed in the Booker T, Emma Booker Elementary School, was to allow Dick Cheney time to take command of all forces, which is clearly what happened as you look at the deconstruction of events that day. But there's a very clear record, and one of the most telling anecdotes that I come up with is that Major Don Arias, who was the press spokesman for 1st Air Force at Tyndall Air Force Base, which is where operational command of the fighters was being held, it turns out that everybody knew that Flight 175, the second plane, had been hijacked and was headed toward the second tower, and nobody issued a warning to anybody in the second tower saying you're going to be hit. And I found stuff that came out right after 9/11 that shows that Major Arias left his post. He had a brother working in the World Trade Center and picked up a normal telephone and called his brother in the World Trade Center, the South Tower, and said, get out of that building now. Now, why didn't NORAD warn? Why didn't the FAA warn? Why didn't the White House warn? I've clearly established that they all knew that Flight 175 was on its way to strike the second tower. And yet you have an Air Force officer having to use a telephone to tell his brother to get out of the building.
Yeah, kind of odd, especially when during the commission there were questions about, well, couldn't somebody have just picked up a phone? There was all this emphasis on using secure lines. And, you know, it almost seemed like people forgot that there were just regular phone systems or purposely forgot. Now, you mentioned before we took that first break that the National Command Authority goes down from the office of the president to the vice president. And you mentioned regarding Bush that day, in his absence, Cheney mm-hmm. was in charge. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, and the Secret Service, someone overrode a Secret Service agent's decision on the Bush detail before he went into the classroom to pull them out of there. And from someplace that was overruled, and Bush, you know, we all saw him on camera. We saw him kind of hop around the country for several hours. And there was, it seems like a deliberate effort to keep him away from Washington, yeah. keep him out of the loop. And it was revealed on the June 17th hearing when I guess it was Captain Charles Leidig was mm-hmm. asked something along the lines of, you know, you're at the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon. Why didn't anybody call Air Force One? Which, mm-hmm. again, Secret Service detail, anywhere Bush or the president or vice president goes, has all this communications gear. They need to be gotten in touch with at a moment's notice, and they need to be able to get in touch with pretty much anyone they want at a moment's notice. Do you feel that's the case, that Bush was intentionally kept out of the loop?
Well, yes. I mean, and the key is, and you mentioned the name several times, is the Secret Service. What you had in Florida was the case of a Secret Service and the president's detail agent being overruled by Secret Service standing next to the vice president in the PEOC. That's two different locations now. You have to. There are three different loci or centers of power that were in play on 9/11. One is the National Military Command Center, which is like the war room in the Pentagon. The second is the White House Situation Room, which is what was described by Richard Clark in his book, which is upstairs in the White House where Clark goes through all of his recounted interactions with all of these government figures. But the third is the Presidential Emergency Operations Center in the bunker in the basement of the White House, and that's where Dick Cheney, Lynn Cheney, and key political operatives were during the attacks. The PEOC is where the Secret Service maintains the Joint Operations Center, which has the complete redundant. It has all of the FAA radar systems, all of the command and control systems. And Cheney was operating down there. There's a great quote in Clark's book where Cheney kept hanging up on Richard Clark during the course of the events. That's because Cheney was issuing orders elsewhere, and Clark was just playing a big charade. But there are things called national special security events, and if you just go to Google and start searching, what you'll see is that in any major national security event that's pre-planned, the Secret Service is, by law, the primary agency for control above the military, above the FBI, above any other agency. The Secret Service is number one top dog. And throughout the course of the day on 9/11, I've pulled up a number of excerpts showing that there was a Secret Service agent in WTC-7. That's where their office was, but there was one right at the beginning of the attacks. There were Secret Service agents at Reagan National Airport, at FAA headquarters, and they were the ones relaying the orders from Vice President Cheney, which determined the true course of events on that day.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at a whole bunch of different things here and trying to figure out exactly where to jump next. Because I may have already inferred, folks, the 600 something pages of this book is extremely dense, and you don't have to be familiar with 9/11 research in general to get through the book, but it does have some benefits to have some context above and beyond. Just picking this up for the first time.
Well, it's critical because it's a detective story, and I have presented a case that I would take into any courtroom or any grand jury in which you have to show means, motive, and opportunity to commit the crimes. That's what you have to show to get a conviction. And when you start talking about motive, then you have to backtrack to the whole issue of peak oil, diminishing hydrocarbon energy reserves, and the fact that Dick Cheney and the U.S. government was well aware of the fact of what we're actually seeing now, which is the fact that world oil production has probably peaked and it's going to go into irreversible decline, which is going to be probably the single biggest event in human history.
Right, and you recount how back in sometime in 1999, Dick Cheney, then CEO of Halliburton, was talking about peak oil, kind of in private public events regarding the oil industry, and that this entire issue of peak oil energy scarcity, or specifically hydrocarbon scarcity, basically determined the outcome of the 2000 election, because, you know, there couldn't, you know, sort of like the entire 9/11, there couldn't be stuff left to chance.
Right.
It's too serious an issue. I guess I just still want to stick with the war games because, as you mentioned at the top, it's really sort of the crux of the biscuit. Now, NORAD confirmed in, let me see here, April 19th of 2004 on CNN, an article by Barbara Starr, NORAD confirms that military and civilian aircraft have posed as hijacked airliners in their exercises. And There's the famous question asked by, I guess it's an FAA person at NEADS, who, when first told of the first hijacking, said, "Is this real world or exercise?" Now, if you're conducting an exercise using airplanes, first off, the entire military superstructure has to be at least aware of it, as well as civilian air traffic controllers, so they don't start responding to things that are just drills. But even above and beyond that, NORAD was theoretically doing a over-the-pole response to Russian attacks as the drill. That was the public explanation. So why would someone routing air traffic, hearing of a hijacking out of Massachusetts, think it was coming over the North Pole?
Well, nobody would. That's part of the sleight of hand that was played by everybody, because if you read the 9/11 final report, the Kane Commission final report, they only mention one war game, and they mention a war game called Vigilant Guardian, but they mislabel and mischaracterize Vigilant Guardian as the over-the-pole Russian bomber drill. There is no way that that's going to be contaminated. If you go, however, to the record of the press stories and the interviews from Aviation Week, Space Technology, from ABC, from a whole bunch of different sources that came out right after the attacks, you see something completely different. The Toronto Star especially did some great stuff, and Canada participates in NORAD. What those stories say clearly is that, and they're quoting Air Force personnel on the record as saying Vigilant Guardian was a hijack drill, not an over-the-pole exercise.
Right.
And on the day of the last hearing, from the Wilderness Head, we have an incredible reporter named Mike Kane, who is just an up-and-coming bright star. And he was fully briefed on this. He had read my chapters before he went to the hearing, and he confronted the General Eberhardt, who was the commander-in-chief of NORAD. He confronted everybody who was there. And all he could get was a no comment. And all the Kane Commission did was continue this deception to try to make people believe that Vigilant Guardian was some over-the-pole exercise. No, That was the drill called Northern Vigilance, and I have a copy of a press release from NORAD saying that Northern Vigilance is the over-the-pole exercise. So they were trying to do a shell game.
We're going to take our second break here, Mike. Okay, so we're going to bring Mike back for the final segment here. Michael Rupert is author of Crossing the Rubicon and publisher of From the Wilderness online at fromthewilderness.com.